ride.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody. Hope you all had a wonderful weekend. Today is July 20th, 2026. Our top story this morning, or the theme, the pattern this morning, war at sea, making food and energy more expensive. And I'm not just talking about in the Strait of Hormuz. This is a couple of different places now. In particular, we have three conflicts at sea now, or two that are raging and a third threatening to start up again. Let's start with the one everybody's familiar with, the Strait of Hormuz. It was active all weekend, conflicts, missiles and drones crisscrossing in the sky. It seems to be escalating. We've got more attacks on infrastructure versus military targets. We've now got desalination plants, power plants, and bridges getting hit in both Iran and the Gulf Coast countries. So that has been a marked escalation. Now this morning, it seems like for a little while, we're back to this game of deal or no deal in oil markets. Around 7:30 a.m. Eastern time, we had a story breaks that there was a proposal about a ceasefire was made. Oil takes a dip. Several minutes later, we come out with the Iranians saying, no, absolutely not. Oil goes back up. And then within a few minutes of that happening, we've got Houthi and the Blowfish. They're out there. They're now threatening to get involved again. In particular, using some very colorful Houthi language, the Houthis have out threatening a maritime embargo on Saudi Arabia. They basically said no more Saudi ships, with the implicit threat of attacking shipping in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Oh, that other maritime conflict. Remember the one we fought like a year ago or 2 years ago that we really didn't win? We spent a lot of money, blew up a lot of stuff, but never really achieved what we were hoping to. Yeah, well, that's threatening to start up again. The Saudis have been getting ready for this conflict. I don't know if that means they're ready to enter with ground troops or whatever, but the Houthis are threatening to shoot at Saudi ships, which would indicate we're probably going to hear about a Saudi ship getting hit in the Strait at some point. And, you know, the Houthis' target selection has never been great. When they say they're going to hit one specific country's ships, they tend to just blow up anything that sails near their coast. So we'll have to see what happens with that one. But remember that east-west pipeline from Saudi Arabia that has been the primary means of diverting oil around the Strait of Hormuz since the Iranians shut down the Strait. Almost 5 million barrels a day have flown from east to west through Yanbu is the port on the Red Sea. Well, most of that oil goes south through the Bab el-Mandeb and then off to Asia. Well, if the Houthis are starting to get frothy, well, now your only option is to go north through the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, and into the Mediterranean. And then what do you do if you want to go to Asia? Sail all the way through the Mediterranean, around Africa, and then go to Asia? Maritime trade is a mess here. Now, as all that is going on, we've got the Reserve Bank of India is out there intervening in Forex markets to prop up the struggling rupee. Or at least that's what they're saying. If you go look at the chart, you can't see any trace of it. So if the Indians are defending their currency, they are doing a shit job of it, because the rupee is within striking distance of its all-time low against the dollar here. And why is the rupee so weak? Because of the oil trade, because the Indians are entirely dependent on oil imports. Oil imports are paid for in dollars. The Indians need dollars. How do they get dollars? Most Indian firms have to sell their rupees to buy those dollars, and they're selling a lot more of them to buy a lot more dollars these days because of the more expensive oil. And like magic, you've got a currency crisis in India. Now, again, supposedly the Reserve Bank is intervening. You can't see it in markets, and they're not the only ones doing this. Remember, we've been talking the last few months about the Japanese doing the same thing, also to very limited effect. But at least when the Japanese do it, you can see it in the chart. I don't know what the Indians are actually doing here. But now we've got that other maritime conflict going on, not the one in the Strait of Hormuz, not the one threatening to flare up in the Bab el-Mandeb. Now we got to talk about the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. We've been talking about that one quite a bit over the last few weeks, with the Ukrainians launching an unprecedented wave of drone strikes against Russian shipping, the Russians retaliating against Ukrainian grain shipments in the Odessa region. Now we've got Bloomberg out this morning warning of higher food prices because of this conflict. And also going on this morning, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium has suspended all loading at the port of Novorossiysk. Now, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, that connects the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea. So you've got a lot of Kazakhstan and a lot of Russian oil that goes through that pipeline into the Black Sea, thus reaching the global market. That's about 1.5 million barrels per day of oil flow. That has now been shut down because of Ukrainian drone strikes on ships while they're loading at that port. Again, global trade is a mess this morning. Now, a little closer to home and a little less doomy, we've got Domino's earnings this morning that were a mixed bag. Domino's profits were up year over year, but same-store sales were lagging somewhat. But Domino's stock is having a good morning. We've got Ryanair. That is the Irish budget airline, and all the budget airlines are struggling here. Ryanair, no different. That stock is falling this morning after their profits fell on lower fees and higher jet fuel costs. Now, that is interesting. Higher jet fuel costs, but they were unable to pass those costs on to consumers because Ryanair services the lower-end consumer who just won't fly if they raise their fees. And so the profits are getting squeezed. We saw something very similar from Chinese airlines last week. Now, we've also got an update on Cyclospora. Look, everyone's getting the runs, and we have no idea why. So that's fun. That's what you call low-hanging fruit. If we're going to make a joke, it's almost too easy. So I think we're just going to move right past it. But yeah, we got an update from the FDC on that one this morning. I'm sorry, the FDA, not the FDC. And last but not least, we got to talk about this story. I just love this. Insurance wrappers for private credit. I've got the air quotes going this morning. Yes, insurance wrappers for private credit. What do you do when you've got all these dog shit assets that you can't sell, certainly not for what you're advertising to your clients that they're worth? But your clients want their money back. What are you supposed to do? Well, you take all that shit that you can't sell after telling your clients they can't have their money back. You put all that crap in a box. You write insurance on it, and then you sell the box. That is what they're doing right now with private credit. And again, if only somebody had been warning about this for the last several years, over and over again, ad nauseum, morning after morning, if only somebody had warned us. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head? Let's see what's happening in the world of finance. Don't forget the like button and the subscribe button for YouTube algorithms so you can come have your coffee with us tomorrow, because we do this every morning. And right now, the S&P 500 is up by 33 points or 0.45%. You may notice this little outlier deviation. What would you call that? A blip there? That was the announcement of a proposed ceasefire from one of the mediator countries. And then a few minutes later, the Iranians saying, uh-uh. And we go right back down to where we are. You're going to see that in several charts this morning, including the Dow, which is currently higher by 107 points or 0.21% to the upside. Once again, there's that little blip, 7:30 a.m. the proposal, 8 a.m. the rejection, rinse, repeat. We get the same thing on the NASDAQ, which is leading the way higher this morning, up 234 points or 0.82% in the green. Again, a big jump on that 7:30 announcement and then a rejection from the Iranians. Also, since we're talking about tech here, having a pretty good morning. We did have a little bit of volatility in South Korea last night. The South Korean Kospi Index was down 4.5% yesterday. It's actually a pretty small move relative to what it's done for most of this month, but still South Korean stocks selling off a little bit. They were closed late last week for holiday, down another 4.46% yesterday. And we have an interesting development here. This one is in Finance Big Go, and I saw a couple different versions of this talking point, and I was having trouble verifying it, which is why I haven't talked about this yet. But apparently the source of this information is the financial services regulators in South Korea, and so this is legit. South Korea's leveraged bull market implodes. 1.2 million retail investors face margin calls as forced liquidation rate surges from 2.1% to 10%. This is nutty, and this is several days old. A leveraged bull market in South Korean equities fueled by the AI boom is undergoing a brutal collapse. As of July 13th, keep in mind, this is as of a week ago, over 1.2 million retail margin accounts nationwide had triggered margin calls, equivalent to one in every 30 adults facing potential liquidation. Holy shit. One in every 30 adults in the country of South Korea has gotten a margin call. And that was as of a week ago. The volatility has continued. Stocks have continued to fall in the last week. So it seems reasonable that that number has only grown since then. The forced liquidation rate has surged from an average of 2.1% over the past 6 months to above 10%. Margin debt concentrated in Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, which together account for one-third of total market margin loans, triggered a liquidity cascade as both stocks plunged simultaneously. I warned you guys about a month ago when we saw that story about people selling their freaking life insurance and taking out bank loans in order to buy these stocks. When everyone and their brother is in the same trade, who is left to buy? The answer is nobody. Now they're all getting margin called. And that's why we always say on this channel, no FOMO. No FOMO. When everybody else has fear of missing out, let them. Don't touch it. By the time everybody's FOMO trading, it's already too late. The money has already been made. Suckers by the top. And this is what happens. Meanwhile, this morning, we've got a dollar chart that doesn't seem to want to populate for me here. There we go. Let's set that to 5-minute candles. The DXY is higher by 12 basis points or 0.12% in the green, 100.89 for the U.S. dollar. And looking over at the bond market, we've got yields are a little bit higher this morning. The 30-year is up by almost 2 basis points at 5.083. The 10-year yield is at 4.563. That's higher by 2 points and change, still below that 4.6 threshold. The two-year yield is at 4.194. That's higher by 2 points and change. And the 1 month is at 3.706, unchanged this morning. Looking over at the commodities market, we've got a mixed bag this morning. Spot gold is lower by $7, but over $4,000 at $4,010 here. That's down by about 0.2%. Spot silver is higher by about 80 cents at $56.76, 1.43% higher. I like the shiny. Copper is lower by 1.6%. Platinum is lower by 1.25%. Palladium is up by about 0.7%. And crude oil right now is unchanged here, 81.69 for WTI crude. That's lower by about 8 cents. I'll show you that chart in a minute here of crude oil. It's been all over the place this morning. But before we do that, let's check in on Bitcoin, down $31 here, $64,641. It was a quiet weekend for Bitcoin here, pretty much unchanged over the last few days. All right, so let's talk about some of the stories that were going on. This is all relatively fresh, so the mainstream financial press hasn't quite gotten their articles out about this. So we're going to go with some of the Bloomberg Terminal stuff. This is Redbox Global on X. Senior Iranian source said that mediators have proposed a 10-day cessation of strikes to find ways to revive the Iran-U.S. interim deal. And apparently these were Qatari negotiators that proposed this 10-day. It's not a moratorium. It's not a 10-day cessation of strikes. Is that a ceasefire? I don't know. The last time they ceased fire, they didn't cease fire. So maybe we're just going to call it a cessation of strikes. But either way, that was the proposal. That was at 7:30 a.m. is when that came out. And then several minutes later, we've got in the Hormuz letter, Iran directly rejects U.S.-backed Qatar's new proposal of a 10-day ceasefire that would halt U.S. strikes on Iran in exchange for Iran opening two Hormuz shipping lanes, with Iran's senior negotiating member Mirandi saying, don't even think about it. This follows Iran's formal MOU exit 2 days ago. They formally exited the MOU, which was a shit deal to begin with, and everybody knew it was never going to hold. But yeah, okay, they made it formal. And Iran's deputy foreign minister, something I can't pronounce, Garababadi, maybe, stating that Iran will never start negotiations with the U.S. under any circumstances. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. So what did oil do? These are 1 minute candles, and you can see here in the chart, there's the proposal, 7:30 a.m. oil sitting here around $81.60. And after the proposal, it drops to as low as $79.60. So oil drops about $2. Then the Iranian says, no, get bent. And oil goes right back up where it was. And then right now, we're basically back to where we were before this whole silly exercise started. But then a few minutes later, we got this one. This one from Javier Blas on X. The Houthis of Yemen announce a maritime embargo against Saudi Arabia effective immediately. Saudi Arabia has until now exported 4.5 million barrels per day from Yanbu in the Red Sea, most of it heading south through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait between Yemen and Djibouti. And then this is the post here from the Houthis using some very colorful language here. Yemeni armed forces declare maritime embargo against the criminal Saudi enemy based on the equation of an eye for an eye, effective immediately. We affirm the right of our great people to respond. Okay, yeah, foolish acts. We call upon the people of our great nation. We extend our greetings with pride and reverence of our great Yemeni people. Somebody take away their thesaurus. Anyways, the Houthis are threatening to get involved here. And this seems a little bit more intense than some of the prior Houthi threats. Things like effective immediately maritime embargo. So you can expect them to shoot at a ship at some point. I'd be surprised if they didn't here. But for now, oil reacted to the proposal of the ceasefire and then the rejection of the ceasefire. But we didn't really get much of a reaction to this Houthi threat yet. So I guess the oil market is questioning that at the moment. All right, but now with the Houthis and the Saudis potentially going at it, it's worth pointing out this story from a couple of days ago in Breaking Defense. U.S. clears nearly $2 billion in precision weapons for Saudi Arabia. The deal comes a few days after Saudi Arabia and Iran-backed Houthis traded fire, ending a four-year truce. This was from July 16th, about 4 days ago here. U.S. State Department has approved a possible foreign military sale of precision-guided weapons for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a deal that would be worth an estimated $1.96 billion. The announcement made Wednesday by the Department of State specified that the Kingdom had requested 20,000 Advanced Precision Kill Weapon Systems, or APKWS. Half of them with air-to-air guidance sections and the other half air-to-ground. Okay, so this is pretty important. The APKWS is a relatively new innovation from the U.S. military. What we did was we took these 70-millimeter unguided rockets, which are basically just point-and-shoot rockets. They're not guided at all. And they created this bolt-on kit that puts a semi-active laser seeker on it. So now instead of just pointing and shooting, the pilot can point a laser at something and then fire one of these rockets, and the laser will zero in onto the target. It can be used for both air-to-ground and air-to-air. So these kits only cost about $20,000, and then the rocket is like another $50,000 to $60,000. So this is the closest thing to cost parity that the U.S. or anybody has for shooting down drones. The alternative to this is to use Patriot missiles, which cost anywhere from $2 to $4 million a pop, or you could use these rocket kits that are basically like $20,000. So the Saudis last week bought $2 billion of this stuff because they're getting ready to defend themselves against drones, both Iranian and Houthis. So Middle East conflict doesn't appear to be settling down anytime soon. And that's why we got this story. The RBI, or Reserve Bank of India, intervenes to support the rupee as the currency nears record low. India's central bank stepped into foreign exchange markets to support the rupee after the currency weakened toward a record low as a renewed surge in crude prices weighed on sentiment. The Reserve Bank of India sold dollars in both offshore and onshore markets, traders familiar with the matter said, asking not to be identified because they aren't authorized to speak publicly. The spokesperson for the RBI did not immediately respond to an email seeking comment. The rupee fell as much as 0.2% to 96.4575 per dollar, putting it back within striking distance of the record low of 96.96, touched in late May. Authorities have taken steps to shore up the currency. On June 5th, policymakers unveiled measures to attract more foreign currency into the country by easing rules for investments in domestic bonds and encouraging dollar deposits from non-resident Indians. The rupee strengthened to as much as 94.143 in late June following the announcement, along with the MOU and oil prices dropping, but since has given up the gains as higher oil prices revive demand for the greenback. USD INR continues to face upward pressure amid higher oil prices and increased importer USD buying. That means the people buying the oil need dollars in order to buy the oil, so that's putting pressure on their own currency. That's from Barclays PLC strategists, including Mitchell Koteka, in a note. The RBI's recent measures to encourage FCNR, that's foreign currency non-resident inflows, appear to be falling short of expectations, though we expect some acceleration in the next couple of months. And it's those FCNR inflows is how the Indians have been trying to defend their currency, right? Foreign currency non-residents. So there's a lot of Indian diaspora, especially like in Dubai in the UAE. There's a lot of Indians working there. They're earning U.S. dollars, and Indian banks, under pressure from the national government, have been raising their interest rates in order to attract more of those dollars earned overseas to be deposited into Indian banks. So those Indian banks will have those dollars in order to buy oil with. And so they can stop selling their rupees in order to get the dollars and buy the oils. And that has apparently had minimal success here, because if you look at the chart of USD INR, this is the number of Indian rupees it takes to make one US dollar. All right, here you can see at the end of May, we hit our peak. That was the all-time low, if you will. When you see this chart heading higher, that's the rupee reaching a low against the dollar. It takes more rupees to make $1. Then, of course, we had the memorandum of understanding, and the price of oil fell, and you saw the rupee strengthened along with it. As the chart heads lower, that's the rupee strengthening. Then, of course, the deal fell apart, and over the last few weeks, we can see the rupee weakening again. Now, somewhere along the lines, the Reserve Bank of India stepped in to intervene in markets. Now, when a central bank intervenes in markets, you would expect a big red candle like that, like we saw in the USD JPY charts. I can't see it anywhere on this chart. So whatever the Indian central bank is doing to their currency in order to defend it from the higher oil prices, it ain't working. And the same thing goes for the Japanese. I mean, let's bring up USD JPY here. I mean, at least the Japanese central bank and the finance ministry has had some limited success. Like a couple of weeks ago when they defended the currency here, I mean, that red candle, that was the Bank of Japan defending the yen. You can see that big step down. But even that, ever since then, just grinded higher. So they've been unable to arrest the declining trend in their currency, both in India and in Japan. Dollars are coming up short globally, guys. Dollar shortage seems to be the way of things. Look, I know everybody loves to talk about how the dollar is dying and, you know, the world is de-dollarizing, and there are certainly efforts to that effect, but you can see it in these charts. The world right now is more desperate for dollars than they have ever been. And in that other conflict at sea, what the surge in Black Sea attacks means for food prices. This one in Bloomberg this morning. Russia and Ukraine have stepped up attacks on each other's commercial ships and ports in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, threatening grain exports and sending international wheat prices to a two-year high. Other key foods such as corn and rapeseed have also rallied. The disruption isn't yet on scale of 2022, when Russia's full-scale invasion effectively suspended loadings at Ukrainian ports, pushing grain prices to records, but it comes at a difficult moment for the food industry. The throttling of the Strait of Hormuz due to the Iran war has imperiled flows of fertilizer and other key inputs used by arable farmers, heat waves and shriveling crops in Europe, and a developing El Nino weather pattern threatens further damage to farm yields. Keep an eye on that El Nino pattern, by the way. I've been doing some homework on that one recently. That could get ugly. There's a reason why Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 triggered the sharpest surge in global food prices on record. The Black Sea is one of the world's most important agricultural export corridors, handling a significant share of wheat, corn, and sunflower oil trade. Ukraine's ports are critical gateways for exports to countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia that can't easily afford more expensive grains from other regions. Russia is the world's largest wheat exporter, and the Sea of Azov connects its ports to the Black Sea and onward to global markets, handling roughly one-third of the country's seaborne wheat exports, according to Kepler. Russia supplies about one of every six tons traded globally, making uninterrupted access to the corridor critical for global food markets. Russia and Ukraine are also key suppliers of barley and sunflower oil. Black Sea wheat is usually the cheapest global source, said Matt Darragh, grains and oilseeds analyst at Kepler. Price-sensitive buyers will either reduce import demand or face higher prices. Either way, this would drive global food inflation higher. And that is the key there. This would drive global food inflation higher. Maybe not to 2022 levels. That was the worst on record. But this is one of many factors putting upward pressure on food prices here. And those attacks in the Sea of Azov are also affecting energy here. Caspian Pipeline Consortium oil loading suspended after drone attacks on tankers, CPC says. Two oil tankers were attacked at the Caspian Pipeline Consortium terminal off Russia's Black Sea coast, CPC said on Sunday, adding that oil loadings were suspended. The Asia and Nissos IOS tankers were attacked during loading operations. The Asia tanker caught fire, which was extinguished. So this Caspian Pipeline Consortium loads about 1.5 million barrels of oil per day out of the Novorossiysk, that's a tough one to pronounce, oil terminal, which is on the Russian west coast near the Black Sea. It takes oil from Kazakhstan and the Caspian Sea through Russia all the way to the Black Sea. That is now shut down. It's the second time in the last couple of weeks they've shut that down. So there's another 1.5 million barrels a day of oil that is being taken off the market because of these conflicts at sea. And it's not just crude loadings. We got this one also from Javier Blas this morning. Morgan Stanley reckons that more than half of Russian oil refinery capacity is down due to Ukrainian attacks. Typically, Russia is the world's second largest diesel exporter, normally around 11% of global seaborne trade. Of course, Russian diesel exports are now nothing point nothing because they have banned exports of refined fuel. And this chart that Javier Blas posted, it's a little blurry, but this is showing refinery outages unplanned as measured in millions of barrels per day. And you can see right now where we are right here, this is projected afterwards, we're looking at about 4 to 4.5 million barrels per day of refining capacity in Russia is experiencing unplanned outages, meaning something probably blew up at those places. That's the Ukrainian drone attacks. They're really affecting global energy markets here. All right, on a slightly more positive note, we got Domino's Pizza reported higher profit as same-store sales growth slows. It was a pretty good quarter for Domino's, but not a great one. Domino's Pizza reported a higher profit and revenue, but slowing same-store sales growth in the second quarter. The company reported a profit of $135.8 million, or $4.07 a share, compared with $131 or $3.81 a share a year earlier. All right, so that's decent growth there. Analysts polled had expected $138.9 million, or $4.17 a share. Okay, so it was a miss, even though the profit grew. They missed estimates. Revenue rose to $1.19 billion, up from $1.15 billion a year earlier. Revenue growth was driven by higher franchise royalties and advertising revenues, as well as an increase in order volumes and food basket pricing to stores, the company said. Analysts had forecast revenue of $1.18, so it was a narrow beat for revenue. U.S. same-store sales growth slowed to just 0.1% from 3.4% a year earlier. Same-store sales grew 2.1% among company-owned stores, while franchise same-store sales were flat. Analysts were expecting same-store sales to fall 0.3%. All right, so there's a lot about the same-store sales to talk about. Analysts were expecting them to fall 0.3%. So the fact that they grew 0.1, that's technically a beat. That being said, same-store sales growth of 0.1% amid, what do we have, 4% inflation, 3.9% inflation, whatever it was, most recent number. So that means real sales are in decline. Adjusted for inflation, sales are declining. And the sales were a lot better a year ago. Now, the other thing I would notice is that the same-store sales for company-owned businesses were 2.1, while the franchisees were flat. And if you notice in their revenue, they're saying revenue growth was driven by higher franchise royalties. Okay, so they're cranking up the fees on the franchisees, and then the franchisees are not seeing any same-store sales growth. That's all the company-owned stores. It looks like Domino's may be abusing their franchisees in order to inflate corporate earnings. That is not good. Ask Subway how that went. Right now, though, Domino's stock looking pretty good here, higher by 7.1% ahead of the opening bell, $345 a share, higher by $23 ahead of the opening bell. Meanwhile, we got Ryanair shares fall after profit drops on lower fares and fuel cost headwinds. Fares decreased 6%, taking a hit from consumer hesitancy, later bookings, and concerns about jet fuel supply. And I'll be honest, I was really surprised to read that byline there. Lower fares, down 6%. Airline fares are not supposed to be getting cheaper. Unless, of course, budget airlines, which caters to the lower K of the economy, they can't pass those costs on to consumers. The consumers just won't fly. Shares in Ryanair slid after the budget carrier posted a drop in fiscal first quarter profit, hit by lower fares and fuel cost headwinds stemming from the conflict in the Middle East. In European morning trade, shares were 6.5% lower to 24.28 euros and are down 18% so far this year. The Dublin-listed airline on Monday said it made a net profit of 537.7 million euros for the 3 months through June, compared with 819 million euros in the same period last year. So about a 30% decline in profit. That's not good. Revenue did edge higher to 4.38 billion euros from 4.34. The airline flew 61.3 million passengers, up 6% on the year, but fares decreased by 6% in the quarter, taking a hit from consumer hesitancy, later bookings, and concerns about jet fuel supply, the airline said. The conflict in the Middle East has weighed on Ryanair in recent months by driving up jet fuel prices and prompting customers to book closer to departure due to heightened uncertainty. Ryanair stock is not looking so hot this morning. It is down 4.8%, trading at 24.70. Again, this is priced in Europe because this is an Irish stock. Not a good day for Ryanair. All right, more good news. The FDA says Taylor Farms' cyclospora finding was a false positive. So we are back to nobody knows why everybody is getting the runs. Oh, that's good. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said on Sunday that laboratory experts rechecked the lettuce samples results from Taylor Farms in an investigation into an outbreak of the cyclospora parasite and concluding the finding should be considered a false positive. As of Sunday, there were no confirmed positive sample results for cyclospora, the FDA said. The FDA on Saturday had said that a sample of shredded iceberg lettuce supplied by Taylor Farms had tested positive for the parasitic illness that has sickened thousands of people in the U.S. It's actually tens of thousands. A spokesperson for Taylor Fresh Food told Reuters that the company was informed the FDA made a mistake. To be clear, at this moment, FDA has not identified a single positive product test for cyclospora, the company said. Taylor Fresh Foods added that it had completed a voluntary recall of iceberg lettuce from central Mexico out of an abundance of caution based on the initial information given. So we're back to nobody knows why. And I was grilling some burgers this weekend with my neighbors, and I offered them lettuce on their burgers, and the guy said, heck no, no lettuce until further notice. So, we're back to not knowing. All right, last but not least, oh, man, there's a lot I could say about this one. This article, this one broke late yesterday. Wall Street alchemists tap insurers to unfreeze private markets. In other words, they found a new place to dump their bags. Bankers and advisors are devising wrappers, repacks, and more to turn private fund assets into more appealing products. In other words, they're hiding that shit in grandma's annuity. The pitch from UBS Group was worthy of a double take. In a blast message to sophisticated investors, the bank sketched a product that initially looked familiar, a bundle of stakes in private credit funds to be repackaged into a bond. Yet potential buyers needed only a few moments to flip through the presentation and realize it was no routine deal. The instrument, with features outside the scope of most credit ratings, would be stamped with a target grade of A2 from Moody's, analogous to the level of risk awarded to multi-billion dollar companies such as Nike and Home Depot. But what kind of financial alchemy could turn perpetual funding for private credit and asset class stirring global anxieties into something that looked rock solid? The answer? A rare kind of insurance provided by Nationwide Mutual Insurance, known to American buyers of cars and houses for its earworm jingle, Nationwide is on your side. Recent pitches and deals involving UPS, Cantor Fitzgerald, Partners Group Holdings, and others are emblematic of the rapidly evolving realm of fund finance, where creative bankers and advisors are devising all sorts of ways to unlock cash tied up in private assets in just a few years. A corner of Wall Street's once considered a backwater has roared to life as its most active laboratory. bundling up assets, slicing them into tranches and varying size and risk, and weaving in other innovations. Often the goal is to create investment-grade debt that can be sold to insurers, annuity providers, and pension systems. If only somebody had made a movie about how this could go horribly wrong, costing millions of people their savings and their jobs. If only. Beware that word innovation. Whenever you're talking about finance, man, you do not want to hear the word innovation. That is not a buzzword. That is a red flag, big time. When a backer like Nationwide agrees to guarantee or wrap a portion of an investment vehicle against losses, it essentially passes along its own strong private credit, its own strong credit rating to that tranche, turning an asset that might have guaranteed few buyers into one with broad appeal. If another insurer scoops up some of its portfolio, for example, it doesn't have to hold as much capital against the asset. Because when you write insurance on the box, it looks less risky, and they don't need to hold as much money in reserve. It's still the same steaming pile of dog shit, but we wrote something else on the package, and so it looks better. One risk is that if such deals proliferate, buyers may someday find themselves leaning on the stability of a handful of firms, said Andrew Ellul, a finance professor at Indiana's University Kelly School of Business. If the insurer's rating is downgraded, then every tranche it wrapped will be simultaneously downgraded, leading to potentially correlated downgrades across an insurer's entire wrapped portfolio and forced selling by investors, said Ellul. I am not saying this will happen if you have a few deals, but if the market becomes bigger, financial stability risks could be material. Okay, if the market gets bigger, those risks could be material. Has the market gotten bigger? Fund finance deals are proliferating and changing so quickly that it's hard to draw lines around the market and gauge its total size. Oh, good. We have no idea how big it is. Haynes Boone, a finance-oriented law firm, estimates it may already amount to $1 to $1.75 trillion with a T, up from a few hundred billion a decade ago. Oh, good. Insurance wrappers for private credit. And again, guys, the reason why private credit is gating redemptions is because they can't sell this garbage, at least not for what they claim it's worth. So instead of selling it, they're putting it in a box and they're writing insurance on it. They're selling it to grandma's annuity. $1 to $1.75 trillion of this stuff. What's the worst thing that could happen? Please don't answer that. Hey, guys, I just want to say thank you for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the algorithm, should you feel so inclined. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. There are links down in the description, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.